sets of railroad tracks to the hotel. He walked straight to the desk and told a chalky white clerk, "Give me the key." The clerk didn't hesitate, and I still followed, a little shaken. Did he keep a room here to act out some extravagant fantasy? He turned the key in a lock, and I went sheep-like into the room. My first impression was that I was in a city bus station very early in the morning. People sat and lounged on every available space. Three bodies were draped over a bed. Men and women sat on the floor, backed by the wall. Two women sat in one chair, and all, black and white, were dozing off or waking up or fast asleep. No one noticed our entrance. Troubadour reached back for me in the dim lamplight. "Come on," he said. I reeled and tried to shake my sluggish brain awake, but it couldn't compute the situation. It seemed a slow whole minute before the scene registered. This was a hit joint for addicts. Fear flushed my face and neck and made the room tremble before me. I'd been prepared to experiment with drugs, but I hadn't counted on this ugly exposure. As I watched the wretched nod and scratch, I felt my own innocence, as real as a grain of sand between my teeth. I was as pure as moonlight and had only begun to live. My escapades were the fumblings of youth and to be forgiven as such. I twisted for the door behind me and tried to snatch my hand away, but Troubadour held on. "Come on," he said. "I want you to see something." I was afraid to scream and alarm the addicts in their dreaming. If I pulled free and reached the lobby, would the desk clerk know I wasn't going to the police and allow me to go? Troubadour tugged at me, and we stumbled over outstretched legs toward an open bathroom door. In the bathroom, he removed his jacket and gave it to me. He rolled up his shirt sleeve. Time for Troubadour and me moved as if we were swimming underwater. He took a tablespoon from the sink and a small square of paper from his pocket. The senses of sound, taste, and touch had disappeared, but I had never seen so clearly or smelled so acutely. The powder was dusted into the spoon, and he dribbled a little water over it. He held three matches under the belly of the spoon while the mixture simmered. The sweet smell went into my nose and unlocked my tongue. I said, "Don't do it, Troubadour. Please don't." He said, "Shut up and watch me." He tied his arm above the elbow with his tie and tightened it with his teeth. Then he took a syringe from the grimy face bowl and filled it with a hot, clear liquid. High-standing keloid scars ran down his inner arm, and the black flesh was purple and yellow in a place with fresh sores. He pushed the needle into a scar and wiggled it around, then took it out and tried another. I said, "Please, Troubadour." He said, "Shut up and watch this." The needle pricked one of the soft scabs, and rich yellow pus flowed out and down his arm to the wrist. My tears, which had been terror-frozen, thawed at the sight of the man who had been so nice to me, jabbing and picking in his own flesh, oblivious to the pain and the ugliness. The needle found its place, and blood mixed with a few drops of heroin had snaked across his upheld arm. He loosened the tie with his teeth, and as if I had X-ray vision, I watched the narcotic reach his brain. His face muscles slackened, and he leaned heavily against the wall. "Yes, now. You want some?" Slow lips, slow question. I said, "No." He said, "You sure? I can cook it up for you." His head lolled, but he kept his eyes on me. I said, "I'm sure I don't want it." He said, "Then I want you to promise me you won't use it. It's nothing. You're a lady, Rita. I don't want to see you change. Promise me you'll stay like I found you. Nice." I said, "I promise." He said, "Let me rest a little in the car, then I'll take you home." He slumped behind the steering wheel for a half hour, and I watched him. I thought about the kindness of the man. I had wanted him before for the security I thought he'd give me. I loved him as he slouched, nodding, his mouth open and the saliva sliding down his chin as slowly as the blood had flowed down his arm. No one had ever cared for me so much. He had exposed himself to me to teach me a lesson, and I learned it as I sat in the dark car, inhaling the odors of the wharf. The life of the underworld was truly a rat race, and most of its inhabitants scurried like rodents in the sewers and the gutters of the world. I had walked the precipice and seen it all, and at a critical moment, one man's generosity pushed me safely away from the ledge. He finally awakened and we headed back to Oakland. In front of my house, I told him he should take his clothes. I explained that I planned to move back to the city. He said, "No, you sell them. You need the money. You've got a baby. There are plenty more stores, and there are plenty more clothes." The next day, I took my clothes, my bags, and my child back to my mother's. I had no idea what I was going to make of my life, but I had given a promise, and I had found my innocence, and I swore I would never lose it again. When I'm asked, you know, how did you make it, you know, if one looks at my life and considers that an anthropologist or a sociologist would look at my early life and say, I'm a born loser, have to be, child of a broken family, raped at 7 and a half, growing up in poverty, black, in the South, without parents, direct parents, an unmarried mother at 16, it would seem that, you know, there's no way out. But I've had so many people be kind to me, and I've always recognized kindness, you know, mm-hmm. no matter how it might be shielded, you know, or tendered. And when I think of Troubadour, which is not his real name, but when I think of that man, I've dedicated the book in part to him, because he was so kind. When a human being allows another human being to see her or him at his most base,
yeah,
that's a gesture of such generosity that it's hard to even write about it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does in turn, hopefully, make me generous, so that I wrote the book to say to young people, you might encounter many defeats, but you must not be defeated. Look ahead, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And today, I'm a Chubb Fellow at Yale University. Honorary degrees from Smith and Mills. I speak 7 languages. I'm distinguished professor at 3 universities.
You are listening to a special broadcast of From the Vault featuring Maya Angelou on Pacifica Radio Archive's annual Holiday Campus Campaign Fund Drive. I'm Philip Muldery of KPFA in Berkeley. I can't begin to tell you how important it is to support the Pacifica Radio Archive, this repository of the voices recorded by Pacifica stations over the years, is an invaluable treasure that deserves your support to be preserved and to be disseminated to people everywhere. So won't you contribute what you can to the Pacifica Radio Archives? Give us a call at 1-800-735-0230.
A good wife and a good mother and about to be a grandmother.
Wow.
That's fantastic. That's the stuff. So how then, except that I've had a lot of help, which immediately makes me responsible for being a lot of help. You see?
Did you write poetry before you began your autobiographies?
Yes, I wrote poetry from about 12 years old on. I've always tried to write it.
Mm-hmm.
I love poetry so, you know, in the black music and in the written poetry as well, but I loved the church songs and the blues because the lines are so pretty. There's mm-hmm. a blues that says, if you don't believe I'm sinking, look what a hole I'm in. And if you don't believe I love you, look what a fool I've been.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty stuff. And a line in, again, old blues, it says, he's blacker than midnight, teeth like flags of truce. He's the sweetest thing in the whole St. Louis. They do say, the blacker the berry, sweeter is the juice. It's such a pretty thing. And one line in the blues says, my baby is chocolate to the bone. So I love that. And of course then there's a line, green trees are bending, poor sinner stands a trembling. That's so pretty. The poetry is asked to be magical, mystical, lyrical, and musical. And so I grew up on that poetry, and I knew it. I don't know how I knew it was poetry, but I knew it then. So I started writing it badly, but I still tried, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you've always loved reading.
Yes, I couldn't hardly live without it, even now.
Mm-hmm.
I read constantly. And, of course, a lot for information's sake,
mm-hmm.
just to know how people live and, you know, facts, but also for my spirit, for the sake of my soul.
I remember in I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings that you said one of the first men you fell in love with was William Shakespeare.
Yes.
And how did you come to that? That first of all, it's so hard to read for anybody, but for a child to approach it and assimilate it and see the beauty in it.
But there were so many things that seemed so clear to me when I was, again, after I had been raped. I went through a period where I just couldn't talk. I could talk to my brother, but I couldn't get the words out. And there was a woman in the town, Mrs. Flowers, black lady, who took me to the black school and said she wanted me to read that whole library. So she started me at A, and she said, I want you to read to D by the time I come back to Stamps. And she used to go away for 4 or 5 months.
Mm.
And I did. And then after I'd read every book, understanding maybe a 100th of what I'd read, she brought me books from the white school. I don't know how she had contacts at the white school, but she did. And she used to bring 4 or 5 books. I'd see her coming up the road, you know. And she'd have her arms filled with books. And I knew they were for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Shakespeare, I found The Rape of Lucrece, which is an incredible piece of an incredible work. And in it, he talks about time and opportunity. After Lucrece is raped, she blames time, and she blames opportunity and night. And I could understand that. So I read it and loved it. And then I read the sonnets, and some of them I could understand. I loved When in Disgrace with Fortune, because it was my position.
Mm-hmm.
It was the position of many blacks. It could have been written by a black poet who would rather have somebody else's color, somebody else's skin and hair and position. He says, when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone bemoan my outcast state. I trouble a deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate. I'm wishing me like to one more rich in hope, like him with friends possessed. I'm desiring this man's art and that man's scope, and with what I most enjoy, I'm contented least. It certainly could have been a black person's position and need. So I loved Shakespeare, and I wanted to recite Shakespeare mm-hmm. when I did start talking. But of course, I knew I'd have to tell my grandmother that Shakespeare was white, and that would be the end of that. I thought maybe if I told her he was dead and had been dead a long time, she might forgive him, but no, didn't work.
Do you, I noticed in your own poetry, there's a lot of rhyme and strong rhythm, and I was wondering if you preferred writing in form rather than, did you come first to try to emulate poets that had used strict form and strict
yes,
meter?
I did. First, another poet, I loved Paul Laurence Dunbar, mm-hmm. who has the most intricate kinds of rhymes and rhythms, because he wrote in the black language of the time, and he just was so successful, and I loved his poetry because it all sang. I also loved Edgar Allan Poe for the same reason. The poem sang. I mean, there was rhythms and counter-rhythms and polyrhythms, and when I first started, that was my intent, to write everything. Everything was in rhythm. I mean, in strict tempo, rather. Mm-hmm. And then, as I worked at being a poet, I found that every subject I wanted to deal with had its own rhythm. So when a poem seems to be out of form, it is not. It has its rhythm. It might not be rhymed, and the rhythm might not be strict. The tempo might change.
But it follows an internal rhythm.
There is an internal rhythm to the piece.
Mm-hmm.
So when I start to write a poem, I think about the subject. And then I write everything I know about the subject down. So it might take 10 or 15 pages. And then I live with that until I can figure out what is the rhythm of this piece, you know. If it's hopscotch, there's a rhythm to it. If it's women crying, there's a rhythm. If there's loss of love, there is a rhythm, depending on whether you're talking about a day, or an old love, a new love. And so then I let the content dictate the rhythm. Then I work to bring it within that form, within that framework.
Yeah. I think we should read some of the poetry now.
Okay.
All right? Since you mentioned hopscotch.
Read hopscotch.
Read hopscotch.
Okay. Hopscotch, wherever it's jumped, has the rhythm dun-dun-chun, 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 and the turns, dun-dun-chun. Well, in Harlem, New York, or Harlem, Winston-Salem. That's the rhythm, but then there are other rhythms laid on top. So it becomes dun dun jinka da dun gun ka dun 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 jinka da dun gun ka da da dun, so forth. And what the children think who jump it in Harlem are other thoughts than those who jump it on Park Avenue. So I wrote Harlem Hopscotch. 1 foot down in hop is hot. Good things for the ones that's got. Another jump now to the left. Everybody for himself. In the air, now both feet down. Since you're black, don't stick around. Food is gone, rent is due. You cuss and cry, and then you jump too. Everybody's out of work. Hold for three and then twist and jerk. Cross the line, they count you out, but that's what hopping's all about. Both feet flat, the game is done. They think I lost. I know I won.
Beautiful.